Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry met with President Vladimir Putin, Kerry's first visit to Russia since the Ukraine crisis began. But did anything significant come out of it? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Key. For this Politics Wednesday edition of our program, we look at politics at home and abroad with our analysts, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. We'll also get their takes on the failure of the president's fast-track authority in the Senate, the surprising election win for conservatives in Britain, and what that means for the future of the EU, and what role will foreign policy and national security play in the upcoming elections. Join our conversation. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived, and we're looking at politics at home and abroad today with Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, and Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Wayne joining us by phone. Hello, Wayne.
Hi, Ben. Hi.
And Jim joining us in the studio, our studio in Ames. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Ben.
And we want to tackle a number of items this hour. We'll talk about that election on the weekend where the surprising win came for the conservatives and what that may mean for the future of the European Union. John Kerry meeting President Putin of Russia. That's his first visit to Russia since the Ukraine crisis began way back in early 2014. A number of other things we want to talk about as well. But first, let's talk, gentlemen, about the failure of the president's fast-track authority in the Senate. It's a key component of the president's trade agenda, his economic legacy, failing yesterday in a critical test in the Senate as Democrats blocked consideration of a bill that would give the president so-called fast-track authority to negotiate this massive 12-nation trade pact. I wanted to get into the various sides here of what the disagreement is about, but perhaps, Jim, you can provide us with a better understanding of what this bill is about, this bill known as the Trade Promotion Authority, TPA.
Sure. This goes back actually several decades in the Trade Reform Act of 1974, when the Congress for the first time authorized the president to negotiate and to then bring a bill to the Congress, which they would vote up or down. Part of that original package in 1974 was that actually there would be sets of legislators that would be involved in the negotiating process. There would be also the sort of interest groups involved on any trade pact. But the key point here is that this would be voted up or down in the House and the Senate without any opportunity for amendment. Now, in that Trade Act of 74, they didn't extend this in perpetuity. They extended it for particular periods of time. And what we've had over time is sometimes the Congress, in their will and in their wisdom, decides to renew Fast Track, or as it's been since the Bush administration, Trade Promotion Authority. And so this is what the latest version of this. The last time that Congress gave this permission to the president ended in 2007. So this is just simply a new effort here on the part of the administration to get this Trade Promotion Authority. So the key point is that the president would be empowered to negotiate a pact, a free trade agreement or any trade agreement, then he would bring it to the Congress. And there's actually in the legislation a set periods of time that couldn't be bottled up. It has to be voted basically within 90 days of being submitted to the president.
So River,
submitted to Congress, excuse me.
Yeah, Wayne.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something to that. The reason this is so important for the president is if you allow congressional amendments to the treaty, then it would have to go back to negotiation with all the parties in the treaty, which would undercut the negotiations completely.
Okay. River to River listeners, you've been following it in the news on Iowa Public Radio. Do you support the Pacific trade deal? Why or why not? Should the president's party have parted ways on the issue of fast-track authority? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's listen to the big players in this controversy here. Here's President Obama speaking at Nike headquarters in Portland last week. President Obama making his case for this Trans-Pacific Partnership.
I want to acknowledge, because this looks like a very well-read and informed crowd, that there have been a bunch of critics about trade deals generally and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And what's interesting is typically they're my friends coming from my party. And they're my fellow travelers on minimum wage and on job training and on clean energy and on every progressive issue. They're right there with me. And then on this one, they're like whooping on me. But I tell you what, I've run my last election. And the only reason I do something is because I think it's good for American workers and the American people and the American economy. I don't have any other rationale for doing what I do than that I think it's the best thing for the American people. And on this issue, on trade, I actually think some of my dearest friends are wrong. They're just wrong.
President Obama speaking last week at Nike headquarters about the Trans-Pacific partnership, and we reported the critical test in the Senate failed, his trade agenda failing in the Senate, at least initially here. Here's Republican Majority Leader Senator Mitch McConnell yesterday talking about the failure to advance fast-track authority and saying it would have implications for future trade deals.
Other countries are taking a look at us. They're wondering whether we can deliver. We hear TPP is close to being finalized. And here's the headline they see, that every single one, with one exception, I believe, of the president's own party in the Senate, prevented the mechanism for having trade considered, prevented it from even coming to the Senate floor.
Okay, Democratic Minority Leader Senator Harry Reid pushed for broader consideration of trade issues.
Mr. President, the reason for this situation we're in today is very simple. The Finance Committee reported four bills out by a large bipartisan vote out of the Finance Committee. The Majority Leader decided on his own that he would consider two of those, and the others would have to figure out some other way to get done. As the Republican leader said this morning in his opening statement, let's move to those two bills and then we'll start the amendment process. Mr. President, do all four start the amendment process. It's very logical what I just said. It's illogical what he has stated.
Okay, Minority Leader Harry Reid, it's easy to get caught into the weeds here in the machinations of the Senate here. President Obama knew he would have to rely heavily on the support of Republicans. He also needed some pro-trade Democrats to move this fast track forward. Wayne, what happened? And it seems surprisingly so.
Well, I think the difference here is the Republicans just want fast track authority not mixed with anything else. And the Democrats, this is what the four bills is about, wanted to include a bunch of other things with fast track, trade adjustment authority, people who are put out of work to give them money for retraining. There are concerns about a second bill has to do with enforcing the agreement, concerns about currency manipulation. The Democrats want to include that. And then there's another section about imports from, I think, a much smaller point of cocoa from Africa, and the Democrats, it's produced by child labor, and the Democrats don't want to don't want that to happen. So I think that the big dispute is for the Republicans to agree to these other things that the Democrats want.
Mm-hmm. What is Jim at the heart of the disagreement on trade with members of his own party, of President Obama's own party, such as a former member of his own administration, Senator Elizabeth Warren?
Well, I think the issue is whether this trade agreement will displace American workers and displace American jobs, and also that it will give more power to corporations because part of the, at least what's been leaked about the TPP, is that corporations could go to kind of an arbitration bureau to make appeals in terms of their maybe their investments abroad and their actions and so on. So I think that, the sort of the domestic ramifications is what has lost support among among some Democrats, particularly when this election is an upcoming election in the U.S. is probably going to be waged or is already being waged on the middle class and the well-being of the middle class and how they can create more jobs and more income for the middle class. So I think this is a big issue that certainly Democrats want to exploit, and they don't want to sign on to an agreement that would give any indication that they were not following through on that kind of commitment.
Okay, let's get Fred on the line from Grinnell. Fred, you have a question or a comment about this trade agreement?
So what's going to make it any better than the one that we had with South America? My father always said before he died, give to the needy, to hell with the greedy.
All right, Fred. So hearkening back to NAFTA, can you tackle that, Jim? That was the trade agreement from the Clinton era.
That's right. And certainly in terms of the volume of trade that has taken place among the United States, Canada, and Mexico, there has been a real uptick in the size of the volume of trade among those countries. It actually has created a deficit for the United States with Mexico and also and traditionally with Canada as well. But nonetheless, the supporters point to the number of jobs that were created, the expansion of the economy, of all of these economies. I don't think, in some of the assessments that have been done of NAFTA at 20 years, that it has really accomplished all the goals that it had hoped in terms of, with the combination of a developed societies like Canada and the United States helping to lift Mexico out of poverty, that certainly has not been, sort of a success point here as well. And there's obviously other reasons for why maybe more jobs weren't created and it has not been more successful in terms of, the Great Recession. But the hope is, with the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is that here you'd have an agreement that would be basically about twice the size of NAFTA in terms of the population center. Certainly, the nations that are in NAFTA are some of the most dynamic ones in the international arena at this time, and that would stimulate more job growth both in those countries, but also in terms of the United States and the other participants here. Mexico and Canada actually have signed on to the TPP in terms of the negotiation. So it would really expand even further that kind of trade agreement that NAFTA has, and then be in some ways incorporated into the TPP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one other quick thing I would add here: there are supposedly in this agreement, we don't know yet, better protections of the environment and better protections of workers' rights than were in NAFTA. But since we haven't seen it, we don't know that for sure.
Yeah, that's a real problem that has been so much done in secret. I can tell you, I did spend a little time out in the Asia Pacific, and I remember one person in the audience after I gave a talk on American policy. She was really quite vocal about this kind of secret agreement that the United States is trying to impose on their country. And she was referring to the TPP. We really don't know what's in it. And, we have that particular government agreeing to these negotiations, but not sharing the information. And I think that is also part of the issue really within the Congress, although I think these other issues, these economic issues, really are the trump cards for the Democrats. But also the secrecy surrounding the negotiations has not been a plus for the administration.
To wind up this particular topic, what is the future now with this setback for the president yesterday and the Trans-Pacific Partnership backers? What's next? What do you see next, Wayne?
I see a lot of political maneuvering in Washington. My own guess is that we're going to get a compromise proposal. My best bet, what I think is most likely to happen, is this currency manipulation bill, will be separated from the rest of the TPP and put through separately, probably first. I don't know whether it'll pass or not. And then that may make it easier for some of the Democrats to go ahead and support the proposal.
Wait, yes, Jim, yeah. You want to jump in?
Yeah, I think the job training component will be sort of added on. I mean, that has actually been in many of these others, trade promotion authority authorizations that you have for displaced workers and so on. I think that would be also part of the compromise. I think there's another national security component that we haven't talked about. The TPP is really crucial in terms of what the president has said about the Asian pivot. And he is the administration has earmarked the TPP as a crucial economic component. And of course, because it doesn't have China in it, it is a way for the United States to also have some leverage in the Asia Pacific.
And remind us of this pivot to the Pacific.
Well, the idea of the American administration going back to 2012 is that the United States would focus more on Asia. It will move some of its military assets, 60% of its military assets, to Asia. And even though it's been denied by the administration, is clearly, in my judgment, an effort to contain or at least to serve as a stopgap measure for the expansion of the Chinese in the South China Sea area and into Southeast Asia generally.
An increase in trade with these countries presumably will strengthen America's position with these countries competing with China.
Wayne Moyer is with us, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. It's Politics Wednesday, focusing on politics at home and abroad. And let's focus on this briefly before our break. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry held what was called a frank meeting with President Vladimir Putin yesterday. Significant in that it was Kerry's first visit to Russia since the Ukraine crisis began in early 2014. Both sides say that the 8 hours of talks between Kerry and the Russian leadership, the Russian leadership were welcome. Here are some of John Kerry's comments after the talks.
And we didn't come here with an expectation that we were going to define a specific path forward with respect to one crisis or another or have a major breakthrough. We came here purposefully to have a very full and open dialogue with Russia's leaders, the kind of dialogue that is absolutely essential in making progress on the many challenges that we face today. And I am particularly grateful, and I want to express my appreciation to President Putin for the very significant and serious conversation that he engaged in, for the very significant amount of time that he committed to this discussion.
Okay, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry yesterday at a joint press conference with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Pleased with the talks. What are we to make of that, Wayne? There is no announcement of anything after these talks, 8 hours of talks. So what could be the significance? What's the point?
First of all, Putin spending 4 hours with Kerry, I think, is significant. I think the primary element will be Syria. The Assad regime has suffered some recent losses. The army appears to be weakening. Maybe the Russians at this stage are willing to try to begin to work with us in coming up with some kind of peace settlement. I think also continuing fighting in Ukraine obviously was an important part, and trying to bring that to a halt, to enforce the Minsk agreement. I think those are the two biggest things.
Mm-hmm. Jim, Russia says the West and the White House is to blame for the crisis in Ukraine. The version of Russia goes how? Any evidence to back that up? There, I think it's widely believed in Russia that the West is behind that.
Well, I think what gives a bit of a lie to that is clearly there have been Russian soldiers and Russian mercenaries or whatever in Ukraine. So I think that is very hard for most analysts to really accept that that Russia has not been directly involved. And, you know, the Minsk agreement, I went back and looked at it, that was done in February, you know, it really does call for these kind of foreign fighters to leave. And I'm not sure that there's really been any evidence that that has really fully taken place. I mean, there is the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, which is supposed to be the overseer of this. But I don't think there, I've not seen any definitive report that there has been this kind of departure. And, you know, the territorial lines that have changed here in light of the ceasefire have been minimalist here. And, of course, there's been periodic efforts of renewed fighting going on between the dissidents and between the Ukrainian government forces.
And the fact that
blaming the West is for domestic consumption inside Russia. Putin has been playing up the aggressiveness, if you would, of the West to strengthen his political position at home at a time where the economic situation is deteriorating. So I think this is propaganda as much as anything else.
Could it be a sign, as you mentioned, Wayne, it being significant that Putin was willing to sit down for 4 hours with the U.S. Secretary of State, also a sign that they are smarting from Western sanctions?
I think that's right, and that they've been totally isolated. And this may be a sign that he now wants to begin a conversation, which I think could be very positive.
I was interested to note, at least in the accounts that I read, that there was no mention of Crimea. I guess that is totally off the table now in terms of the sort of the Western position. It has been for some time, but I was interested in all the coverage that was done. There were a series of others, Iran, Libya was talked about, Syria, as Wayne mentioned, and, of course, the Ukraine itself. So I guess Crimea is simply a fait accompli, and the American administration is willing to accept that.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute left. Go into the cooperation the U.S. hopes to have or continue with Russia on Iran.
Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, we're in the final stages of the negotiations, and I'm sure Obama wants to be sure that the Russians, who are part of these negotiations, as well as the Chinese and the British and the French and the Germans, all stay on the same page as we get into the final negotiations. And particularly such things as inspections, which I think will be really very critically important in terms of whether the agreement is sellable.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment to continue our discussion on River to River. It's Politics Wednesday. We have Wayne Moyer with us, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. We're going to talk when we come back about the elections in the United Kingdom. Unexpected, of course, the polls weren't predicting this, but the Conservative Party won a decisive victory in the weekend's parliamentary elections. And this may have some ramifications for the European Union and Britain's membership in it. We'll ask our analysts about that when we come back. And also I want to ask them about the role of national security, foreign policy in our elections. Does it play a very big role? What could make it play a big role? What does it look like for 2016? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Politics at home and abroad this hour with Jim McCormick and Wayne Moyer. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday, politics at home and abroad with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. We'd like to have you join our conversation. Last half hour, we were talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this trade fast-track authority that failed the president's backing, backed by the president, I should say, that failed in the Senate, talking about that last half hour. And the conversation on that continues on our Facebook page. David in Fairfield writing this email to us. The TPP rewrites the rules on intellectual property rights that limit fair use, expands the time period that works retain their copyright, and has enforcement provisions that favors the rights of Hollywood over citizens. My opinion is that these types of changes need open review and debate before being enacted. When the president says in the clip you played that he has no motivation because he has run his last election, one can ask, who were some of the biggest donors to his presidential bids? Hollywood and the music industry. This appears to be payback, writes David in an email from Fairfield. As I mentioned, the conversation continues at Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Wayne and Jim, let's talk for a moment about the United Kingdom election on the weekend. British Prime Minister David Cameron and his Conservative Party winning an unexpectedly decisive victory in the parliamentary elections. Polls had predicted a very tight race. Now Cameron says he'll form a majority government, and he says he has a mandate to pursue European Union reform following this election. He wants to renegotiate the terms of the UK's membership ahead of a referendum by 2017. Jim, can you describe for us what is the position that the UK finds itself in relation to the European Union? It's in, or is it?
Well, they've always had kind of a mixed view of whether they should be in or out of Europe here. It's an island nation. It's had a stature as a global power, and it sort of looked across the English Channel to Europe and wasn't really quite sure that it should be in. Its real concern about the EU at the present time, hinges on some financial issues, hinges on some immigration issues that the British public are upset about. I mean, the immigration issue is the migrants coming to Britain and because of the EU rules able to achieve benefits very, very quickly here. And this kind of flood of immigrants to the UK is something that Cameron has been upset about. But more so than that, there's been a party on his right, the United Kingdom Independence Party, that has made that as the kind of the principal issue. So I think Cameron is going to have a very difficult time in terms of his own position, that he'd like to stay in the EU, but he wants it reformed. The question is whether the EU itself will be willing to undertake this reform so that the migrants cannot move or immigrants cannot move from one country to the other in the EU. Under the current rules, there is that kind of free flow of persons here.
If I can just add another complication to all of this, the Scottish Nationalists won big in Scotland. They won all but three seats. They would want to stay in the European Union. If Britain sort of moves away from it, that will increase the gap, I think, between the Scottish Nationalists and the Conservative government. And Cameron faces the possibility of being both out of the EU eventually, and conceivably losing Scotland if there's another referendum.
Mm-hmm. That was the comment from Cameron, from Conrad on our Facebook page. He's wondering, yes, what you mentioned about this landslide of the Scottish Nationalist Party. Now, Wayne, the Scotland has been traditionally a big Labour Party backer in Britain.
It has, but the Labour Party was virtually wiped out in Scotland in this election. And my sense is that the Scottish people thought the Scottish Nationalist Party would actually get them a better deal in Westminster than the Labour Party would. But I think the Labour Party has real problems right now.
Now, the Scottish Nationalist leader says that she doesn't want to have a referendum immediately, that she really wants to sort of make her case in Parliament, in Westminster here, to try to get this, as Wayne said, a better deal for Scotland. And that better deal is going to mean also some more autonomy for Scotland in a variety of areas here.
This UK election with implications on the European Union's future, do you see that having reverberations on this side of the Atlantic? What does it mean for U.S. interests, U.S. foreign policy?
Wayne, I think that it has very significant implications. Britain is the strongest free trade member of the European Union. And if Britain pulls away from the European Union, I suspect we will have more, even more trade problems than we currently do with Europe. In some ways, Britain has sort of helped in terms of mediating between the United States and some of the other nations. And if it's out of the EU, I think it's going to be more complicated.
Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, picking through and analyzing some of the latest politics at home and abroad on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Let me throw this out at you, a report card, a global report card. The U.S. Council on Foreign Relations, also 25 other international policy institutes teaming up to produce this global report card on how the global community performed collectively last year. The report card just issued 10 categories ranked by institutes. Let me see if you agree with the grading, the ranking here. Nuclear nonproliferation worldwide receiving the highest grade, a B-minus, because of Iran, the negotiators, as we mentioned earlier this program, a framework deal in April, trying to get the comprehensive agreement by the end of June. Eight categories receiving grades in C, the C range, including global economy, climate change, and international terrorism. At the bottom, the world's inability to prevent or end major internal conflicts. And also the report pointing out the number of refugees worldwide topping 50 million last year. 50 million last year, that's the highest level since World War II. So good on non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, not so good on resolving conflicts. Jim, are you agreeing with the grading there generally?
I do generally agree with this. I think when I sort of took a look at this, it's a bit depressing about sort of the global community and their ability to sort of to address problems that we all face here. That was sort of my immediate takeaway. I think that if there is an agreement with Iran, you know, that will be hailed as, you know, even more reason for this kind of, I guess, B-minus grade that that was given to the control of nuclear proliferation that would rise up. I think what the other side of it is, of course, is that the failure to do anything about these kind of regional conflicts that are going on, or internal conflicts, I mean, and obviously highlighted by ISIS, but also whether you look at Yemen or Libya here, and the seemingly ineffectiveness of the international community to take decisive and, if you will, effective action.
Yeah, I've just focus on the refugee issue and just how serious that has become, certainly in crossing the Mediterranean, where now the European Union, I think, is even moving in a direction of using military forces, not to shoot, but to sort of go after the people that are transporting these refugees. It's put an enormous burden on Europe.
And this is one of the issues that links up with our just discussion of Britain and the EU, because you know, the EU now is trying to come up with a policy for placement of these migrants, you know, from Africa principally, but the Middle East as well, and that also adds, I think, to this kind of issue that Cameron and the British will face with regard to the EU.
In the final 10 minutes we have with you, let's veer into 2016 election comments here. We're 8-9 months away from the Iowa caucuses. Jeb Bush, the first well-known Republican in the yesterday the first well-known Republican in the presidential field to opt out officially of the Iowa straw poll. This is a poll that takes place in the summer, nationally renowned, that has drawn on some criticism over the last years. But also Jeb Bush in the news as well. On Saturday, Jeb Bush, and he has not declared his candidacy officially, we should mention that, he told Fox News's Megyn Kelly that he'd have authorized the Iraq war, even knowing what we know now. Then yesterday, Jeb Bush took to Sean Hannity's radio show saying that he had misinterpreted Kelly's question. Let's listen to his initial volley and the chance at trying to correct that. This is on the Fox News program, The Kelly File. Bush had this exchange with the show's host, Megyn Kelly.
Knowing what we know now, would you have authorized the invasion?
I would have, and so would have Hillary Clinton, just to remind everybody, and so would have almost everybody that was confronted with the intelligence they got.
Okay, then almost immediately backtracking from those comments when asked about them yesterday on the Sean Hannity show.
I interpreted the question wrong, I guess. I was talking about, given what people knew then, would you have done it, rather than knowing what we know now.
So in other words, if in 2020 hindsight, you would make a different decision.
Yeah, I don't know what that decision would have been. That's a hypothetical, but the simple fact is mistakes were made.
Okay, receiving a lot of criticism for this, Jim and Wayne, with 2020 hindsight, he says he still wouldn't know what to have to do here. So I guess this he didn't do well in avoiding being tied to his brother's most unpopular foreign policy legacy, Jim.
Well, that's right. I mean, I'm kind of stunned when you listen to that he could not appreciate what the Megyn Kelly was asking here. That now the present time, that he would have sort of made the same decision. And then even I think his pullback here doesn't really get him very much off the hook here, because he still is a little bit indecisive about what action would be taken. Because after all, you know, the weapons of mass destruction were the sort of the rationale for the attack on Saddam Hussein in Iraq. So I think he probably has yet another correction to make.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, do you think Jeb Bush will be able to unlink himself from his brother's legacy?
I think it'll be hard. But I have a more basic question, and that is, how important will foreign policy actually be?
Yes.
In terms of how people vote? And most of the time, it unfortunately is not very important. And most of the time, most candidates don't really say very much about what their positions would be on foreign policy issues. And I think, in general, the state of the economy and jobs and stagnation in income are likely to be more important, or will be more important in this election.
Well, questions of all types seem to be avoided by the Democrats' leading candidate, Hillary Clinton. On a Morning Edition this morning, I don't know if you heard this, a report by Tamara Keith focused on Hillary Clinton's lack of answers to questions. In that report, it pointed out that it's been more than 3 weeks since Hillary Clinton has answered a question from reporters. And of course, there's always this tension between the press and candidates they cover. Journalists want access. They want to ask questions. And the campaigns of any candidate want to control the message. Hillary Clinton here, since announcing her candidacy in that web video a few weeks ago, have been no press conferences, no sit-down interviews. It has been a month, and the candidate has answered, according to Tamara Keith of NPR's Reckoning, just 13 reporter questions. Jim McCormick, can this strategy, are we in a new media era where you can ignore mainstream media reporters, steer clear of questions?
No, I don't think you can. But I think part of the strategy here is, you know, there's been a lot of issues that have come up over whether the Clinton Foundation, Benghazi, and so on. And by not answering, I suspect there's a hope that these will at least become less pressing, even when she does start to respond to questions, although you could obviously argue that that would be the stimulus for reporters to bring those back on the scene. But I think there's another reason, too, is that there's been a cacophony of voices on the Republican side, with some disagreements among those Republicans. And so, letting those candidates kind of hash it out, and maybe gives her an advantage. At least that's the way that might be one of the calculations. But I'd be interested to see what Wayne has to say on this
I think you're saying to stay out of the fray unless you're pulled into it. Stay above the fray.
Yeah.
Wayne?
I can see that argument, but I think that her failure to answer questions means the press will get more and more, the media will get more and more insistent, and her failure to answer questions itself will get a lot of publicity, which I think will hurt her.
Let me ask you this question about this coming campaign and foreign policy. The common perception when we talk about other areas, other issues, economic policy, for instance, is that a primary pulls Democrats to the left of the spectrum when they're running for that nomination, and pulls Republicans to the right, especially when running here in Iowa, in the Iowa caucuses. And then after winning the nomination, they have a more centrist attitude, tend to have a more centrist attitude to capture the big middle there. When we talk about foreign policy, Jim, what is right or left in foreign policy? Is there such a thing?
Yeah, I think there is, in the sense of how much involvement do you want the United States to have in the world? How much a shaper attempt to shape the global outcome? I think there has been over time, really since, I would see it since Vietnam, really, since the Vietnam War, you know, a movement of between Democrats and Republicans in a little bit different direction about how they would be involved in global affairs and what, you know, what would be the extension of a set of actions. I mean, there's clearly some polling data that shows Republicans are going to be more likely to rely upon military strength and Democrats more on negotiations in terms of their actions in the international arena. One seek more of a bilateral way to address international issues, another more a multilateral way. Obviously, the issues that come up, you know, can muddy that kind of those kind of distinctions. But I think the tendencies are different for Democrats and Republicans in terms of what actions they would see and what role they would see for the United States in global affairs.
How then do you see Rand Paul, a candidate like Rand Paul?
Well, he has a real problem, it seems to me, in terms of, you know, he tends to be more isolationist and more non-involved, which you might not expect in terms of his particular party label here. And so that may well be a problem for him getting to this kind of middle group, or even to some of the mainstream Republicans who see the United States as playing a much more assertive role in global affairs.
Wayne, your comment on how the parties break down in foreign policy.
With what Jim is saying, Democrats tend to be very multilateralist, tend to want to use international organizations far more than, for instance, than Republicans do. Republicans tend to want to spend more on defense, and a muscular emphasis on defense and foreign policy is very important for Republicans, much less important in terms of the Democrats. So I'm completely on the same page as Jim is that way.
Go ahead, Jim.
I just wanted to add one thing. Maybe I'll just disagree a little bit with Wayne about how important foreign policy will be. I think the foreign policy issues actually could be an important a set of foreign policy issues could be important in the 2016 election, particularly given what the shape of the Iran agreement looks like, what the status is with regard to ISIS, and God forbid if there's some other kind of action domestically on the terror front. So I'm not sure that national security is going to be entirely on back burner. Obviously, traditionally, economic issues, are the biggest and best predictors, but there are occasionally national security elections.
Yeah, I think that's right, and terrorism could come back as well, and how to deal with terrorism, particularly if there's another attack of some sort.
Back briefly to the Iowa straw poll and Jeb Bush being the first well-known Republican in the field to officially opt out of the Iowa straw poll. We have just a minute or two left, but the future of the Iowa straw poll, if people don't participate, I guess that's the one thing. What are GOP presidential contenders weighing when they look at whether to take part in this Iowa straw poll, sort of a run-up to the Iowa caucuses, Wayne?
What are they going to gain out of it, and what do they risk? The last Governor Pawlenty of Minnesota got in, and his campaign was ruined right at that level. I don't see that many candidates will see much to gain from it, and I wouldn't be surprised if other candidates pull out as well.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you see it as a mistake by Jeb Bush to not participate? Or?
No, I don't think so. I suspect that, you know, for Bush, Iowa is not on the top of his agenda in terms of the caucuses. I mean, he's going to another event, from what I read, at Georgia at the same time as the Iowa straw poll. And so I think the candidates really do have to make, as Wayne said, that kind of calculation, whether it would benefit them. Somebody like Huckabee, who has done well in the past and well in Iowa, he may see the straw poll as really a great deal of an advantage for him. Or some candidate who seems to be coming on, whether it's a Rubio or a Walker, they might see the straw poll as advantageous. But these other candidates that are already ticking down low in the polls here, I don't see how much it can benefit them in that particular event.
Thank you for spending the hour with us. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Gentlemen, always a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up tomorrow on this program, a firsthand account of the tornado that struck Lake City, Iowa earlier this week. Also, we'll talk about efforts to keep Iowa graduates in Iowa, about combating the state's brain drain. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth. Also thanks to Julia Davis. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.